This is a spiritual reading being given for Giselle Manneker on Wednesday, the 2nd of October 2024, in Victoria, Australia, by John Rawson. We stand within the cave. And the cave, Giselle, is what one might consider, perhaps term, an intermediate state of being. It's where souls come when they first leave the physical body, or most of them at least. Most souls go out into darkness, and depending on the light, the inner light which they have cultivated in their physical incarnation, it's with that light that they are able to light up the cave, the darkness. They find themselves surrounded. Now, you have asked about the soul when you as Ismael, and I think that I have to be honest with you that the truth is not very pleasant here, that when a soul goes out of the world in darkness, then it finds itself in darkness. And it remains in that darkness until a certain element of life is introduced, when they begin to reflect upon this incarnation. And this happens dimly at first. And the soul looks, as it were, into a mirror held by two beings, a round mirror, symbolizing the perfection of the soul, of course. But the soul looks into this mirror, and depending upon its state of consciousness, how much light it's brought with it, it sees more or less clearly. And if the soul has left this incarnation with a darkened consciousness, in other words, with a consciousness that is filled with despair and denial, and it doesn't matter how much love that person professes to those it's left behind, it's a denial of the relationship and the potentialities of that incarnation. So that soul stands before the mirror and it begins to perceive dim images at first. It starts to see what it did in its most recent actions. And the soul looks at these images, and then suddenly the thought comes like a bolt of lightning, that's me. I did that. St. Paul talks about it in their first letter to the Corinthians as seeing through a glass darkly, or seeing the riddle in the mirror. And he's really talking about this state that the soul enters into when it leaves incarnation without the light of Christ, which is the true light. It's very difficult to be a spiritual being if you're a psychiatrist or a psychologist. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because one would think that psychologists, psychiatrists, who know so much about the human mind and thinking and emotions and all the rest of it, that they would be the closest profession to spirit. But actually, the training, and I'm sorry to say this to you, but the training that is given in the universities and the academies to psychiatrists and psychologists is very, how can I put it, it's only half the story. And the funny thing is that the real story is in the name, psychology, psychiatry, psyche, which is the ancient Greek word for the soul. So that in fact, psychology, psychiatry, should be an understanding of the soul. And psychology is a trap, because if you enter into it, you come to a stage in your professional occupation, your professional career, where you have to make a decision. And the decision is either you go forward and move into working with the soul, or you stay at that boundary and you have to deal with the problems of people with the techniques and the protocols with which you have been trained. And there's many, many psychologists, psychotherapists, etc., who do great work with those protocols. And to go beyond that can be very dangerous for that person. I suppose the classic example is Carl Jung, who almost had a nervous breakdown when he had to go through that barrier into working with the soul in reality. And of course he could never explain to his fellow psychoanalysts or analytical psychologists what he'd done. So it wasn't until after he died that his journey and the pain of passing through that barrier was made manifest to the world. Why do you think people become psychologists / psychiatrists? Well, we would say, for a start, it's in the colours, the aura colours. So in your case, your first aura colour, which is the vibration, is a horrible word, but I might use it anyway, it's the vibration, the energy level at which the soul chooses to interact with others in this incarnation. Now, if your first colour, for example, is light red, then you might be an entertainer, a performer, a networker, because light red is the person who gets along with ease with other people. Or, I'm giving the ideal case, there are many light red people who have quite dysfunctional personalities, but basically the light red colour is an ease of connecting with other souls. Blue. If blue was your first colour, you'd want to be a hermit. You'd want to, you might be very good with people, you might be very insightful, but you're basically, you would spend your life longing for spiritual understanding. When I look at your colours, your first colour is purple, which is a combination of red and blue. Your second colour is orange, which is a combination of red and yellow. So, first of all, I want you to understand that the reds, which represent energy and emotional energy and emotional passion, they are part of who you are. You give your love away far too easily. You give yourself away in relationships. You fall into love too easily. You are would be an incredibly romantic. And what's more, because the reds are in the purples, you would want to do anything you could for the other person to the extent of giving away what you need, what's required. It's like your sense of self dissolves. You would sacrifice yourself for someone else in a heartbeat. Probably have done so, and then discover that was a real mistake. But that combination of red and blue is what makes you such a good psychiatrist, such a good psychotherapist, because it enables you to understand that human beings are both emotion and thinking. I'm putting it very straightforward here. But there is, with those two colours, there is the ability to enter into a soul, into a consciousness. And I don't mean you do this consciously, but your emanation, your soul emanation, enters into the emanation of the other person, and this is able to take on, to start facilitating change. And that brings me to another question. What's wrong with people? Why do you have clients? Why are there people in the world who are dysfunctional? And of course, you might say it's because of their childhood upbringing. You might say it's because of trauma within their lives, something that happened with their parents, abuse, all sorts of things. There's all sorts of reasons for people to become dysfunctional, as you know. But in reality, if we look at it from another point of view, from a spiritual point of view, the reason people are dysfunctional is because they have been become disconnected with the self, and that's the self with a capital S. There comes a time in life where one is faced with the cross, and you can take that metaphorically, but I'm going to, or in reality, that the cross represents the suffering of life. And unfortunately, it is through suffering and pain that we are most powerfully empowered to make changes. Now, it's not the only way to make change. But when one confronts the cross, and I'm not, don't think of a cross like a crucifix, think of it as an equal armed cross with a like a graph axis, with the x-axis, the horizontal arm, at the y-axis, the vertical arm of the cross, and there are four quadrants. Now, what the cross represents when you meet it is that you you are presented with an opportunity to make a movement. Now, the cross represents two forms of movement. It represents movement in a horizontal direction. And what that, and because we're talking about consciousness, you see, cross is a decision about consciousness. One can choose to move along the horizontal direction. And horizontal is, I suppose you might say, it's thinking, intelligence, or what the world regards as intelligence, so that people who use their minds with great mental facility, they are further, have higher scores, as it were, on the right arm of the cross. They move further out. And psychologists and psychiatrists, it's obviously going to be a long way out on that horizontal arm of the cross. They've got, you've got university degrees, for God's sake. So you have huge scores in terms of mental ability. But the problem is that the more intelligent in this sense that we become, the less we recognize that it's only intelligence in one direction. And the further out we go, the more we actually lose sight of the vertical arm of the cross. Now, the vertical arm of the cross is what one might call spiritual consciousness. So that the horizontal arm is mental consciousness, what we think of as the mind, and the vertical arm is spiritual consciousness. Now, someone who starts proceeding up the spiritual arm, the increasing spiritual consciousness, is someone who starts to see further, because the further we climb, the more of the landscape we can see. And as we climb and increase in spiritual consciousness, so we start to understand our life and our purpose. In fact, once we get to a certain stage on this y-axis of spirituality, if you like, once we get to a certain stage, we come to realize that we have a purpose. And once we reach that stage, then we reframe life within our purpose. I'm going to come back to Ismail for a moment. Ismail was a very intelligent person. I can imagine he'd be a great psychiatrist. He would know so much. But the more he knew, and the more he thought he understood, the further he moved along that horizontal arm, the more he lost sight of the vertical arm. And because of that, he lost sight of purpose. Why do people become healers? Well, one could say it's because they're filled with compassion. And they want to help people. And that's true. That's great. Compassion is fantastic. And we need healers within the world. We need people like yourself with compassion. We need people like Ismail, who I'm sure had a lot of compassion, and who had knew a lot as well. And I know that you do amazing work. But the sad truth is that many people who become healers in this incarnation are redeeming themselves from an incarnation where they hurt and caused pain to other souls. And Ismail had an incarnation, oh golly, 15th century, I think, 16th century, yes, soon after the Spanish invaded or came into South America. And in this incarnation, he was a priest. I can see him in a black gown. Not a black gown, actually, it's more of a dark charcoal grey. I think he was a priest or a monk of the Cistercian order, but he was tasked with running the Inquisition. Now, the name that comes to me is Nueva España, or I presume is New Spain, and I don't, my history is not of South America is not good enough to tell you where or what New Spain was, but here is Diego, as he was then, in charge of the Inquisition, and he was charged with stamping out the heathen religion of the native peoples. And he did this in the only way he knew, through torture, through burning people at the stake if they wouldn't recant, and through basically causing a lot of pain. Now, Diego, as he was then, did not do this because he enjoyed causing pain. In fact, in his mind, he was doing it to redeem souls. Of course, he wasn't redeeming any souls. He was causing a hell of a lot of pain. But nevertheless, his intention was good. And what happens when you have a life where you cause a lot of pain? Well, what it means is you come back in at some later stage, which he has done in this incarnation, with the intention of repairing that pain. But you know, that pain that you create in that previous incarnation, that attaches itself to you. It's like carrying a huge burden around with you. I don't know whether you're familiar with the English writer John Bunyan, who wrote a story called Pilgrim's Progress, and in the story, which is an allegory, pilgrim who, or Christian, who is the everyday person, is making a pilgrimage to the heavenly city, which is really a life story. And he begins by carrying this huge bag, this huge burden on his shoulder. And John Bunyan, who was very visionary, saw truly that many souls bear a terrible burden with them in this incarnation. And there's really only two options. When you come into incarnation as Ismail did, bearing such a burden, you either get crushed by the burden eventually, and that may come in terms of a mental breakdown, a nervous breakdown, a physical illness, physical condition, a sort of a, sometimes it comes as a sort of schizophrenia. That's probably not quite the right word, but the person becomes unable to properly engage in relationships because of this, the weight of what they are carrying. So one can be crushed by that burden. And the other option is that at some point in the life, this person can drop the burden. They can come to a point in life where they are given the choice to release the burden. Now, Christ doesn't want you to carry your burdens around, so don't go picking up all these other people's burdens, Giselle, by the way, you've got quite enough to carry around for yourself. So don't pick up anyone else's. But there come two points in everyone's life, by the way, where we meet Christ. And I'm not saying that you have a vision of someone on a cross or someone on the road to Damascus, as the Bible would put it. Now, what I'm saying is that you encounter a situation, or perhaps it's another person, who creates a space for you to make a choice. And that choice is, are you going to give your burden over? Give it to Christ. Christ can carry all our burdens. In fact, he already has. We don't need to carry it. We just need to acknowledge that we have certain debts in the ledger. And then if we let the burden go, then we can actually be much more powerful within our incarnation. So Ismael walks along the path of life, and he's a very brave soul. He's carrying a lot of pain. I'm tempted to say that, I'm sure this doesn't apply to you, but I have seen in my life, working with many people, often people go into psychiatry, psychology, in the hope of releasing and resolving their own inner pain. Now, I'm not saying this is what Ismael did, but he was carrying this. Now, I don't know where his first meeting with Christ was. Perhaps it was through a teaching moment, perhaps it was through a professor, perhaps it was through some form of therapy that he had to engage in himself. But he came to a second point in life. The first point, he didn't recognize Christ. He didn't recognize that he could be an individuality and he could drop the pain. So he comes to the second point in life, and that's his encounter with you. That indeed, this was a meeting that both souls had agreed to before you ever descended from the spiritual worlds. And you, as souls in the spiritual worlds, you knew each other. You had a love relationship in spirit. I can just mention one little anecdote, if you like, to illustrate the quality of your relationship, that in the 13th century, I think it would be, you were 12th century, perhaps, perhaps the 12th century, you were a ruler, a queen, you were in a female body, you were a ruler, you were you were incarnated in France, and as I see it, you were married to the king. Now, the king actually wasn't very interested in you. You were a political marriage. You came with a lot of property and a lot of estate, to which would help him increase his own property and his own estate. Plus, he wasn't a very sexy guy. He wasn't interested in sex at all. But he was very pious man. In fact, that was part of his problem. He was so pious, he thought that not having sex was a good thing. I don't know how he ever expected to get an heir to follow him on, but anyway, there wasn't much sex going on there. So you had an affair with this young guy, who was well, as I see it, he's sitting there with this red velvet cap, and he's playing, I think, a lute or a guitar, and he's singing to you, and he's singing all these songs about love, and you have a passionate relationship with him, a really sexual, romantic relationship. You're head over heels for one another. But of course that can't last. The king comes back from the Crusades, and you've got to get rid of this guy. So he flees the castle, because everyone in the castle knows what's going on here. And he's riding his horse, running away, and he's killed by a group of bandits, robbers, I think you'd say, who take his the gold that you'd given him, and he had scrolls of poetry that he'd written, and he had his lute, or his, I think it's a lute, that was very precious to him, and he died quite tragically. Now, when someone dies like that, young, then eventually they've got to come back and resume that relationship, because that was an unfinished relationship that you had with this male in the life in France. So you come back, and there's all this passion and sexual energy, romantic energy, a poetic almost, because that was the energy that was cut off in its prime when he died in his 20s, before he even reached the age when the soul would come in. And that energy had to be rebalanced in this incarnation. And it could have been rebalanced through the experience of Christ, through the experience of individuality. Now, individuality is a tricky thing. It's not associated with one's concept of self, self-identity, etc., etc. If we say, I'm a man, I'm a woman, I'm a Pisces, I'm a doctor, I'm an academic, I'm a student, I'm a this, that, or the other. All those little things, little eyes that float around, make up the tapestry of our ordinary consciousness. But individuality is experienced when all this cloak, this tapestry cloak of identity, when it can be dropped for a second. And there are only a few things that are strong enough to make it drop. Number one, we can have a traumatic experience in life, and that can be a physical illness where we just about die. But near-death experiences are often an opportunity for the soul to discover its real self, its individuality. It can happen through a mental breakdown, a nervous breakdown. Happened like that with Eckhart Tolle, when he almost had a breakdown and he wanted to kill himself. And then he had the realization that if I want to kill myself, there must be two selves. A self I want to kill, and the I that wants to kill it. And then there's a third option, and that is we can have an experience of love that, if we allow ourselves to dissolve into that, we will come across our true self. And you've used the term mirroring, which is really good. I like that term. Because one does mirror oneself in the beloved. But that That third path is a very difficult one. The path of coming to individuality through a relationship is really, really difficult, because one has to be willing to let go of the old. And whereas you would happily let go of the old, I think, you have an almost mystical experience within relationships. You would happily give over yourself to the other. For Ismail, he was more concerned with protecting the edges of his identity. So it was much more difficult for him to release his sense of self and become unified with the within the relationship. And being a very intellectual person, he intellectualized it, he rationalized it, and so I'm sure he left you a beautiful letter saying how much he loved you. But unfortunately, that was the mind talking, not the heart. I'm talking to a psychiatrist, of course. You don't believe the heart can talk. Well, there is a voice within the heart, indeed. Not the physical heart, not the cardiothoracic system, who cares about that? But within the center, the spiritual center, that resides in that vicinity. And that center has to be opened up, because that's the center of individuality, not the head. No, it's the heart. And you were willing to open up your heart. But and you, for that, you've always felt that you needed a partner, someone to be in love with, someone that you could embrace and you could become part of. And so that would have worked for you. But when push came to shove, it was too difficult for Ismail. And that's partly because he was so far along the horizontal axis of the cross that he had lost sight of the understanding that one can also evolve, go upwards, ascend in consciousness. And the thing is that the more we go along the vertical axis, the closer we are to the vertical axis, the more we identify with our normal ego-based consciousness, that's who we are. And we cling to it with great passion. So when something comes along that threatens to destroy this attachment, it makes us feel extremely insecure. Because in order to ascend up the vertical arm of the cross, that's not a matter of acquiring. I mean, going along the horizontal arm, we're acquiring more. We're acquiring experiences. We're acquiring degrees. We're acquiring expertise. We're acquiring all the time. That's about acquisition. But going up the vertical arm is about letting go. And that's very difficult. When someone has acquired a lot, it becomes that much more difficult to let go. Ismail is not now in the cave. He is, as I see him, you have to understand this as a metaphor, a symbol if you like, but he is standing in little outside a little house, and the house is made of stone. For some reason the stones seem to be lying flat, but I'm sure that's neither here nor there. And it's got a sort of a thatched roof, just a little place, perhaps one or two rooms in it. And there's a stone wall all around the house, and he's leaning on the stone wall. He's got a piece of wood, a staff, stick in one hand, and he's leaning and he's looking out at the landscape, and the house is situated in this beautiful mountains, amongst the mountains. And he's looking out, and there are, well, I would call them alpacas, I'm not sure you would call them, perhaps llamas, if I might have got the name wrong, but he's looking out at two or three alpacas grazing down the hillside. And he's all alone. There's no one else. And what this means is that he has been given time to reflect and to come to grips with what it means to be alone. In a sense, Ismael is not 100% culpable, shall we say, for the decision to commit suicide, because he had carried so much pain, not just from the previous life, but also, I suspect, from this incarnation as well. Carrying so much pain that it had become almost impossible for him to release it. And in a sense, Giselle, and please don't blame yourself for this, you were his last chance. It was make or break. And had he been able to go that one step further, then he would have been able gradually, over a period of about 6 or 7 years, to release that pain. And I'm not sure whether to tell you this or not, but I know you would probably think this was your forever marriage relationship, but actually, had the relationship gone as planned before you came into incarnation, it would have lasted for about 6 or 7 years. And then you would have separated amicably, and you would have remained friends. But you would have both assisted one another through the changes that had to happen. And the last change, I think, that you have to achieve in your life before you become freed of the karma that is owed, is to transform your passion, I think I'm going to call it that, and your habit is the wrong word, but your inclination, tendency, no, it's more like an energy, this energy which would take over you in relationships, that incredible emotional experience. And, of course, you've got to have emotion in relationships. You don't have a relationship. You might have a business partnership, but you don't have a relationship if there's no emotions involved. But what we can't do is we cannot let the emotions obliterate our sense of who we are. This is how fragile our normal consciousness is. Any strong emotion, any traumatic life event, and it threatens to push that understanding of self aside and drown it. And that's why people become very panicky sometimes in relationships. Relationships bring incredibly powerful charge into our lives. Now, what you have to do in the next 6 years, and if you'd had the relationship continue with Ismael, this would have happened for you. You have to find the middle way. Not too far, not too committed You can't commit all of yourself, because otherwise there's nothing left to for the other person to relate to. Don't throw away yourself to the other person, and don't hold on to everything. So you've got to find a way that balances it, that creates a dynamic where you can love someone and yet not lose yourself in them. I hope that makes sense. The Buddha was strolling along a riverbank, having put himself through hell, fasted until his stomach was touching his backbone. Gautama was not a person of moderation in those days. He was all out, but like you in relationships, so he's going all out for enlightenment. But he wasn't getting anywhere, and he walked along the riverbank, and there's a musician tuning his harp. And the Buddha says, "What are you doing?" And the musician looks at him and says, "Oh, I'm tuning my instrument. I just want to show you something." And he plucks the string and he says, "Now see, that is too loose. It's not in tune." So he tightens it up. And then he plucks it again. And that, he says to the Buddha, "That's too tight. The sound's too high." So he releases it a little bit. And this time the note is perfect. And that's how the Buddha came to understand the middle way. So if you can take that little anecdote on board, it's the middle way. And the middle way doesn't mean we're half-hearted. In fact, if you achieve the middle way, you are completely committed. You're committed to being in the middle. And when we find the middle way, we are able to be who we are, and we are able to allow others to be who they are. Now, as I've said, you would have progressed to this point over the next 6 years with the aid of Ismail through this relationship. And Ismail is becoming aware of this, and it causes him a deep heartbreak. There is no punishment in the afterlife. Souls punish themselves. They create an environment which is there to mirror back at them what they missed out on in this incarnation and what they need to change. And when you kill yourself, you are cutting yourself off from connection with other people. You're saying to them, whether you understand this or not, "I don't care about you." And that's not the real person speaking. That's a voice which can be so powerful that it can lead the person who's got this voice going on in their inner ear, in their psyche, it can be so powerful that they can take their own life. But they have, because that was an act of "I don't care about other people," when they enter into the afterlife, the post-death phase, which can go on and on and on in terms of depth and height, they will create a situation where they find themselves alone. So the aloneness where Ismail is at present is his opportunity to learn that he needs other souls. And when he comes out from this experience, he will enter into an incarnation where he is totally dependent on other souls. But that's going too far. as far as we'll go. I'm going to complete the list of aura colours, which are basically the same. You have blues around the edge, and the blues are tinged with dark greys at the moment because of the sorrow, the deep sorrow that you feel. If you are able to, at this point in time, do pray for Ismail. Light a candle for him every day. Think lovely, beautiful thoughts about him, because that will help him. It will help his soul reconnect with the other soul. There's a lot of rose around as well, outside the blues, sort of clouds of rose. And rose is the colour of sensitivity, and what that means is that you must be, well, of course you are, still, you must be incredibly heartbroken, and I don't know how you are managing to continue at this stage, because you're so sensitive to everything, and probably everywhere you look reminds you Ismail, and you hear something and that reminds you of Ismail, and you experience something and that reminds you too that you will be like this for the rest of this year. It takes time for that sensitivity not to evaporate but to transform very gradually into a sort of new creativity. And what you will experience in the next 6 years, because your karma's changed, you see, you were going to spend the next 6 years with Ismail, but the lords of karma, they are rearranging certain things within the life, and they've organized for another person, another soul, to enter into your life, not in the next 4 or 5 years, although there's going to be at least one other relationship in about 3 or 4 years' time, I think. But when you get about the age of 50, which is, in spiritual terms, the age of release from the past, and it begins the time in life where we start to ascend the vertical arm of the cross. In other words, our consciousness becomes more spiritualized. There is another soul moving towards you, or being moved towards you, at about the age of 52, I think, that you should meet, and you should have a very strong love relationship. And I think that this relationship, this will be your forever relationship, forever as far as this life is concerned anyway. And again, it's another soul that you have a great love connection with. Light red from the shoulders. Oh yeah, there's all the emotion there. Very emotional person you can be. And because it's on the shoulders, you can be run around by the emotions as well. And so one of your purposes in this incarnation is to transform the emotional energy and to use it to connect with people in a way that creates a space for you and creates a space for them. And it's probably one of the reasons that you became a psychiatrist, is because it gives you an opportunity to create this sort of space. So that in psychotherapy, psychiatry, psychology, all these things, we can create spaces. Now, you need to create a space, that sort of space within your own life, which is really only done through spiritual understanding, through spiritual learning. Yellow inside the head, you are such an intelligent person, as we know. And I can see you figuring it out, working it out, and coming up with reasons. But in the end, don't forget that it's the understanding, spiritual understanding, doesn't reside in the head. It comes from the heart. And the vortex blues. Oh, no wonder you're going through this phase right now. When you have the blues coming in to the head as a vortex, it indicates a very strong period in one's life of about 7 years, and you're about a year into it already, where your thinking and reactions become disciplined through creating or adopting a spiritual framework and understanding. Blue is a difficult energy to deal with because often it goes contrary to our normal ways of thinking. It's counterintuitive very often. Whereas normal consciousness is about acquiring spiritual consciousness, the blues is about release and letting go, which is probably exactly what you need to do right now and in the time to come. And in the finality, please don't say you should have seen it coming. This was a decision that the soul made. And soul decisions are made from a very deep spiritual level. There is a level where we are individuals. You're an individual, Ismail is an individual. And the way we exercise individuality is we make a decision. You would not be permitted to know. It goes against spiritual laws, and there are such things as spiritual laws, and we come up against them at our peril. But spiritual law says that another person's individuality is holy, it's sacrosanct. And so what goes on within their individuality, the decision, should not be counteracted, countermanded by another soul. I think what happened to you was cruel, devastating, and there is no spiritual reason why it happened. I can't say to you it's karma. No one ever, ever, ever comes into incarnation in order to commit suicide, believe me. So even spirit would not have known this was going to happen. I think that what you can do is to forgive yourself. You've got your own pain to carry, to go back to John Bunyan and Pilgrim's Progress. You've got your own big sack. And the next 6 years, you need to let go of all that. All those energies and remembered experiences that are creating pain within your life. Where you feel you're obligated to someone, where you feel you've done someone something wrong. There's a very great spiritual saying that you may find helpful. St. Paul came up with it. He says, talking about debts that he owed and what he should have done and didn't do, he says, put it to my account. In other words, I acknowledge what I owe and I shall repay it. If not in this life, in the future. And then you can let it go. You've acknowledged it and you have agreed to rebalance when you have the opportunity. And to complete, to bring this to an end, Giselle, don't ever regret love. Don't ever regret that you've given love. Be grateful that you've received it, but even more grateful that you've been able to give love in this incarnation. Love never ends, after all. All our wisdom, all our knowledge, all our prophecy, all our clairvoyance, all our spiritual knowledge, they will pass away. But love continues forever. Just be who you are. That being of love, and that will be more than enough in this incarnation, so shall it be.